All right, everybody, welcome to LexLine, brought to you in conjunction with our friends at Rug Radio, where we talk about the new and latest developments in Web3, blockchain, NFT law, and we also love to bring in guests who are active participants in the Web3 and crypto space. As always, nothing we talk about should be considered legal or financial advice. If you've got specific legal questions, you should always do that privately with a lawyer, not on a recorded Twitter space, because we do record these spaces. And if you miss the live broadcast, it, of course, will be available. You can catch it on Apple and Spotify podcasts. None of the views expressed on this show are necessarily the views of the host or the platform, but are the host's questions and answers and the views of our guests. And with that being said, I have a very, very special guest here today, Eugene, the insurance guy, friend in the space, been on several spaces with him, especially back in the heyday of the bull market in the Rug Radio days. So I am delighted to have Eugene in the house to catch up with him on what is going on. Eugene, how are you, my man?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Always great to catch up.
Oh, my pleasure as well. Eugene, if you could start by telling the folks who may not be familiar with you, who you are, what you do, and how you got into Web3.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Eugene Dorfman. I own an insurance company out of Miami, Florida, the sunny state. And we specialize in insuring pro athletes and high net worth individuals across all major insurance lines, primarily life, disability, home, auto, umbrella, jewelry, and all that. And proud to announce that about 3 weeks ago, we crossed over 100 pro athlete clients in a short window of about 4.5 years. So just specializing in a pro insurance space, catering to that marketplace, and then growing from a client to a client in a very, very interesting but boring insurance category.
Yeah, look, I'm coming at this from the legal side, and law is fascinating at times. It is, of course, the subject of many TV shows, especially what I do, which is criminal law. Yep. But most people find law probably about as boring as insurance. Nevertheless, it is still an honorable profession, and you do provide a valuable service. How did you make the transition in your life to Web3 and crypto? What attracted you to this space?
So my space, my play in Web3, I'm a very, I call it the spectator and holder route. I just, you know, I'm still somewhat young, obviously. So I'm 40. I just turned 41 2 weeks ago or last week. And it reminds me of very, very early internet days. And obviously I was too young for that when it was happening. And I feel that while we're adopting all of that, I just talked about to a friend about it. It reminds me, like, if you follow history, the 1800s gold rush in California, right? And it was a period of, you know, 20, 25 years, and where everybody's kind of, you know, figuring it out, learning things. And there's people that are going to make a lot of money if you understand it early, understand how it works, and, you know, be smart with it. So I felt like this is a space that I wanted to learn. Wanted to understand. Big believer in DeFi, cryptocurrencies, Web3, but I am just a spectator and accumulator. You know, I don't chase any of the meme coin stuff. I hold primarily 4 or 5 major coins since day one. Hold a handful of NFTs, and, you know, it's a bet on hopefully 20 to 30 years from now, I'm right. And if I'm wrong, that's okay too, right?
And I know, I think you and I talked about this offline before we went live, that part of the process is exactly what you discussed, which is learning the technology and experimenting. And while lots of people made a lot of money in the space, a lot of people lost a lot of money in the first bull run, learning and experimenting in the space. And I think both you and I came from the same perspective on that, that it is really the cost of learning and the price you pay to learn something new and innovative. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that, because I thought your insights were very valuable on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll be honest with you. I think more people lost money than made money. I think the ones that made money are people who understood it better. I think greed was a very big driver in the early bull market. Have you ever seen the movie Vegas Family Vacation?
Yes.
Do you remember the scene where Rusty is like, I put a dollar, I get a car, put a dollar, I get a car, put a dollar, I get a car, put a dollar, I get a car. And it was very similar to that, where people were just, hey, I buy this, it goes up. I buy this, it goes up. And none of us really knew where it's going to end. I think a lot of people lost a lot of money. I was very lucky. I think I did okay. I honestly did. I got in early. I had highs that I could have got out of, but I didn't. But at the end of the day, I actually think I'm probably net positive from my total investments.
And I'm sorry.
No, but overall, look, I own a Mutant 8. I told you this offline, right? Like, I had an offer of $100,000 on it, and I literally stared at it, and I was like, I'm not selling it, right? I still haven't sold it, but now it's, instead of 100K, it's worth 12K, 13,000 maybe, right? But to me now, the money isn't going to change. At the end of the day, I always say this, NFTs actually saved my crypto portfolio, because I had my ETH was tied up to NFTs instead of being, originally it was all in BlockFi, Celsius, Voyager, just earning passive interest. And if it was, it wouldn't be anywhere else. Like, that's the reality. And I'm very comfortable admitting it. It was there. And if it wasn't in NFTs, and it wasn't in my Rug Radio NFTs, or my Mutant Ape, or my Cool Cats, or some other stuff that I own, I probably have over 200 NFTs, it'd be there, and it'd be dead money by that point. So at the very least, I'm happy that a good chunk of my crypto stuff was salvaged. So yeah, that's that.
Hey, look, it seems like it was a blessing, especially with the names you rattled off and the carnage that followed with respect to a lot of those earning platforms. Lesson learned, and probably protected you from over leveraging yourself in a lot of stuff that you couldn't get out of because of the eventual collapse.
Exactly. So I mean, look, I had a buddy, you know, that was only in Bitcoin, and he never touched anything else from starting from day one. Bitcoin only, no ETH, no meme coins, no bullshit, no NFTs. Bitcoin, and that's it. Accumulated 13, 14 Bitcoins. Unfortunately, all of them, every single one, was in BlockFi. He liked it. He was collecting 5%. It was, you know, compounding monthly or whatever BlockFi was paying. And he was very happy. He wasn't greedy. And he's wrecked, right? All of it's gone. Like, he's going to get some of it back, but it'll be pennies on the dollar. That's a huge example in this space, right? Because this is somebody that was smart. This is somebody that wasn't greedy. This is somebody that was methodical, and he still got fucked.
What's the biggest lesson you think you took from the 2021 bull run / bear market that followed? And now that we're back in the throes of the 2024 bull market, what did you carry over from that experience into now?
Greed. And if you're reading it on Twitter, it's too late. That's the one thing. So two components, right? Greed, not from a very bad standpoint, but look, like, you know, one of my biggest losses in crypto, I'll be open with, is Luna. So I put $10,000 into Luna. Things went to $70,000, $80,000, and I never cashed out. I mean, never. And that shit went in one day from $70,000 to zero, right? And I'm like, okay, well, that was stupid. All those things, because you understand money, you understand how the world works. I own three companies. I'm a business owner. And you understand that, you know, things are never as easy as they seem like. So one is greed. So cash out when you can. Know what you're comfortable with. And if you're going to, even if you made some money, take some back, right? Take your initial investment back, you know, or know that it could go to complete zero. And if you're comfortable with it, understand that. And two, reading on Twitter. So what you learn this a lot, and I still follow everyone in crypto. I read, I understand. And here's the thing. You're either a buyer or you're a seller. And when you're reading off Twitter, most likely you aren't in these special Telegram chats. You're not in these groups. You're not in Discords. You are the last resort, which is why it saved me a bunch of money so far in the last 2 months, because I haven't really jumped on any of these meme coins that are people are posting this. I made all this money. And it's like 99% of people got wrecked because they're buying at the end. And that's the two things I've learned, right? Stay away from reading off Twitter unless you get it earlier. And then don't be greedy.
Yeah, round tripping tokens is definitely a mistake you want to avoid. And everyone wants that 10X and everyone's holding out. And, you know, when you see that run up, especially on these meme coins, you start to let greed play into it and you start to think this could be the one. This could be the one that 10X is for me. And then you see it crash quickly and you lose not only your profits, but also what you put into it. And that's a painful lesson. So I think that is outstanding advice for how to approach this next run. I want to pivot a little bit to what you do day to day. I know you represent a lot of high profile athletes and you insure them against potential catastrophes, which might end or cut short their career. And I'm curious to know, because obviously you have a trader's mindset in the sense that you are investing in this stuff on the crypto side. You're dealing in the insurance industry with risk, the same sort of risk reward type of play, because you're dealing with actuaries and what is the likelihood of this outcome happening and the client losing their big contract or their upfront or their future gains. How do you evaluate risk from the insurance side when you're there to protect your athletes?
Well, so I'm assuming you're specifically talking about disability insurance, right? So that's,
yeah,
because life insurance is pretty, you know, it's either you're alive or you're dead, right? Disability, I look at it when I advise clients, and I'm a big anti-insurance guy. I don't think insurance solves everything. I hear so many people just selling insurance like it's a pair of steak knives or a new car. And it's all we're doing is what's at risk, right? So for athletes, the conversation that I have with clients is this, and I'm very open about it. And I think that's why I grew so fast, because I'm direct. I say it how it is and I don't tell them bullshit. And I tell some clients they might not need insurance, right? And it's, if you don't do anything stupid or get hurt, how much is at stake next March, which is a free agency in NFL, or next, you know, June, July, August, free agency in NBA? How much is at stake? That's the question, right? And that's a question you have with a client and with their agent, right? And you go, how much is at stake? If you're a borderline player and you're just hoping to get a minimal contract next year, you don't really need insurance. You don't. It's a waste of money. How much money we need to protect? Because insurance doesn't really protect that money. It protects a catastrophe, an event. So career-ending injury, serious injury. If you just sucked or you got cut or you had a banged-up ankle, right? Insurance doesn't cover that. Is the money that we're protecting worth the premium that we're going to spend on it? And that's the conversation. Every player is different. Every situation is different. Some guys, the elite players, they qualify for loss of value, which is the contract insurance. So, you know, I have some of the top draft picks in this year's draft. Each one has a different trigger. So if I get hurt between now and the draft and I fall out of, you know, 50th spot, 30th spot, out of first round, my insurance policy makes up the difference. Some guys don't qualify that. Some guys are, you know, if I don't get drafted, then the policy covers it. If I have a career-ending injury, the policy covers it. There's just different nuances. So it's very important to understand how much money is at risk. So you have to understand the contracts. You have to understand the players. You have to understand what's guaranteed, what's not guaranteed. In basketball, the money is growing to be astronomical. right? So like I'm talking to an all-star NBA player right now, and we figure out a way to get his insurance. He's going to probably get about $200 million plus in a year and a half from now. We have to make a decision, right? The policy premium is $250,000, $300,000. Is it worth it? I don't know. If he never gets hurt, you know, it's a wasted of a house in Ohio. But if he does get hurt, it's probably the best money he's ever spent, right? So that's the conversation that you have to make. And every player is different.
It's fascinating because, number one, I see a lot of parallels between what you do and I do. We're both wired to anticipate risk and to mitigate against it in different ways.
Yep.
And also what I respect about the approach you're taking and why I think you've had success in your industry is because it's very easy for you to sell garbage products to everybody and simply make your premium and get your residual checks. But it sounds like you go much deeper and you are sincerely there to protect your athletes. And your first question is, what is the cost benefit of you plunking down this premium? Which I think a more unscrupulous person in your industry would probably just be happy to get the check and not really do that long-term analysis. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but so here's the thing. I'm a big advocate of knowing that your reputation is the most important thing. And I think very few people understand that in any aspect, in legal services and insurance services and anything, right? What are people saying about me when I'm not in the room? It's easy to be in the room and defend yourself. It's easy to be like, well, fuck you, you're wrong. I'm not that person, or I'm not this, and I do things differently. But if you're not in a room, here's what happens. If you don't like me, Carlo, and you're thinking I'm a piece of shit, or I sell bad policies or whatever, you're sitting in a room and you're somewhere where you're located at, and you're talking about me, my name comes up. You can do two things. One, met Eugene, great guy, amazing guy, and validate what somebody else is thinking. Or you go, I don't know, talk to him, dealt with him, didn't really like him. He was selling me some bullshit and I don't really trust the guy. If I'm not there to defend myself, you're now hurting my business. I always think of that. I always think of, what are people looking at my work, how I do things? If my client is talking to another person, an advisor, an agent, an insurance competitor, about what I did for them, are they going to say, this is good, I would do the same? Or, oh, wow, he sold you something you don't need. Or, wow, this is too much or oversold. I'd rather be in a position where it was undersold. It's good, but I would have done more. Because then it still validates what I did as a good thing.
I take the same approach. It's better to undersell and overdeliver. Yes. And I think it gives you a lot of credibility, not only in it with your peers, but also with your clients. And the most valuable component of it, the client referrals, because these athletes talk. And I'm correct. Sure that when they're in the locker room, they're talking about how either this agent or this financial advisor or this lawyer or this insurance guy did me wrong.
But they might not know that might not got done wrong. You see what I'm saying? But if you're not there to defend yourself or to defend your work, you're not there, you're not giving a press conference every time. So two things that I do. I'm very open. I'm public. My social media is public. I talk about it. I don't hide. I always find it's very interesting when people in the business of people hide. They don't have social media. They don't have why are you hiding? You're in the people business, so you should be pretty open, yet I can't find you? Questionable to me. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I'm curious open. To know, Eugene. This is something that just popped in my head, and I'm really curious to know because I love the process, especially when it comes to entrepreneurs. You obviously did not start as an insurance guy representing high-profile athletes.
No, I fell into
you,
it.
You had to grind away. How did you get your opening? I mean, did you go to training camp? Did you go to football game? Like, how did you grind away and make that and carve that niche for yourself?
So I actually, it's crazy how I got into this business, but I out of college, I got a job in Chicago, normal. I'm a Russian immigrant. I didn't even attend my first football game until I was a sophomore in college. And I didn't attend my first NBA game until I was probably out of college, ironically.
You didn't grow up watching this stuff.
No, I didn't. I mean, I moved to America in 94. I mean, so take first 3, 4, 5 years to just accumulate it to the country. And then I grew up in Ohio. So then, like, you know, I watched the Indians here and there, but I didn't understand it. My first ever football game was my sophomore year of college. My close friend had season tickets, and his parents allowed him to take one person to, like, a friend to each games. And he took me to a home opener on the Browns. And that was, so that was 2002, September was my first football game ever.
Wow.
So not understanding the business of it, I mean, just not understanding any of that stuff. Out of college, I moved to Chicago. Then I got promoted, moved to LA. There I met a sports agent, started learning, doing various things for the sports agent. David Cantor, who's, you know, pretty high up in the business and has a huge list of clients, learned the sports agency business. I did not love the business. I didn't like it. I didn't love it. I like the concept. I like the idea of it, like most people do. Once you get down to it, I did not want to be 40, 50 years old having my livelihood depend on a mood of a 20-year-old. Just didn't like the idea of it.
And this is before, like, you were ever even in the insurance field.
I'm just working for him and having a day job because he couldn't pay me enough money at the time. So my last day job was doing business development for a high-end insurance. And hold on a second. I just got a missed call from
actually no worries,
mom,
of
mom of a parent. Let me talk, sir. We'll call her right back.
It's the beauty of live radio, as we say.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Give me 1 second. I apologize.
No worries. I'm glad to have you here today. I really enjoyed this conversation, Eugene.
Okay, so my last job was working for a high-end insurance company, doing business development. I get a random call from an advisor. This is financial advisor from Florida. This was 2017. He's like, hey, I have a client, contract here. Does your company do disability insurance? I'm like, sure, yeah, of course. And as a saying goes, you know, if somebody offers you an opportunity, just say yes and figure it out later. So I hang up the phone and I'm like, what's disability insurance? So I call David Cantor, the agent. I was like, what's his disability insurance? He's like, oh, you know, guys get it in contract care, et cetera. I was like, okay, cool. Call some PIR people's in New York. I'm like, do we even do it? We figure it out. We do it. The premium was like $50,000, $5 million career-ending injury. So I was on a pretty high salary, so I didn't see any of the commissions. So I asked the gentleman that helped me to do the policy, I said, hey, I'm just curious, like, what's the comp on this? He's like, oh, like, we make like 10%. I was like, oh, it's, you know, 50,000, $5,000. That's not bad. I'm like, if I can you hear me? Somebody else is calling me once.
No, we're good.
Okay. I said, oh, if I can, you know, to get 10, 15, 30 clients, I can make a living out of this. And the light bulb was born, and I kind of put together everything I knew about sports, what I did about insurance, and understanding that there's a bunch of sports agents, there's a ton of financial advisors. And you'll laugh, but there isn't a lot of me's in the business. There just isn't. And there's not any good ones. The competition was very, very, very easy. So I started building from scratch in 2018, doing only disability and life, build that, created my reputation, wasn't easy. I was very visible in the space. I'm at every big event. I'm at every game. I use social media as a big advertising platform of what I do. And it went slowly, but fast, you know, went from 1 to 0 to 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, 16, 30, 60, 100. And now just slowly getting into the NIL has been a blessing because now the guys are making more and more money. So as more money you make, the more insurance you need because you have to protect the stuff that you make. So it's been great. And just building that from scratch now.
That is wild. I'm curious to know, because we're both interested in this technology. We're both interested in Web3, crypto, blockchain tech. Did there ever come a time where you were thinking to yourself, there's got to be a way that I can incorporate NFTs and blockchain technology into insurance and create a whole new product category?
So my first experience with insurance and NFTs happened as the Bored Apes were skyrocketing in value and the phishing attacks were happening. And I was, you know, I said, wow, there's need to be an insurance component of your NFTs, of your digital assets. We went pretty high up through my contacts of talking to the corporate people at Aon and at Hagerty, which is a big carrier for, you know, high net worth valuables. They insure all the collectible cars. And they're just not ready for it yet. They're not ready to put value because the assets are so speculative. They go up fast, they go down just as fast. So it's hard to say, are we putting, you know, let's take my Bored Ape, right? How much value are you putting on it? A year ago it was worth, I don't know, 50,000, the Mutant Ape. Today it's worth 10. Well, if I bought an insurance policy and it's worth at 50, but it crashed within a year to 10, maybe I can pay somebody to get it stolen, right? My conversation was, is that I can do the same thing with cars art, except when I, you know, create fake robberies or burn my car down, the asset is gone. Technically, if somebody steals my ape, it's still there. So you can still find it by tracing the addresses where it goes. So I think the insurance component will probably be easier because the asset is always on the blockchain. It's never actually gone.
That's interesting because to circle back, you're observing very acutely that the fraud, which of course is rampant in the insurance industry where people will fake claims and so forth.
Yep.
And we're not advocating that anyone do that, of course, but that is certainly one of the ways that people game the system. But you discovered that blockchain and when it's specifically with NFTs, you can always find the asset. And we went through this. We went through this with that last market where we had all these flagged NFTs and stolen NFTs and so forth, where people clicked on wrong links and lost their assets. So knowing the amount of fraud that exists already in the insurance game, and then knowing the amount of fraud that exists in the crypto and blockchain space, you say that insurance carriers, even though there is a way to trace the assets, they're still reluctant to touch the space.
Well, they're just not ready for it yet, right? But here's the thing. The blockchain, to me, all right, I'm going to say this. I think the government's behind crypto, Bitcoin, and all that. China, United States, and the big boys. Here's why. Everybody thinks that crypto is anti-establishment. It's actually completely opposite. It's absolutely pro-establishment. The only thing the governments can't trace is cash. They can't do it. So if I go and I have my watch, and I sell you my Rolex, and you pay to me in cash versus a transaction on credit card or crypto, well, I can choose to file it, or I can choose not to file it. No one's going to know. And I accumulate my cash in my little safe, and then I put this cash in circulation. And I keep that cash is not taxed, it's not traced, and I can't do anything with it. If I sell you my Rolex for $40,000 on a blockchain, that transaction is forever. And eventually, with a click of a button, I can just pull up every transaction for that Rolex. If I can attach the blockchain to Rolex and only sell it on blockchain, it'll always, you can see it how it's being sold. It's my opinion. This is my little conspiracy theory. If the government wanted to trace all this cash and all this money and become, control the people, the blockchain and Bitcoin and crypto is how you solve it. people collect and get paid on the blockchain. You pay taxes on a blockchain. You now no one have to make mistakes on, you don't need a CPA to handle your taxes and do write-offs or whatever. You can see everything that you're doing, see exactly how much you're doing, and it solves everything the government has a problem with when it comes to money. But if they said, it's government said, we're making everybody go on blockchain, we as a society would run and accumulate all the cash and create like the underground world like they did in, I don't know, like in future movies.
That's right? Interesting. That's interesting. You know, you're not far off on that conspiracy theory.
I'm not far off. That's why I believe in all this shit, because I'm not betting against the house. I'm betting for the house.
And a lot of countries want to pivot towards a cryptocurrency as far as they want to replace cash with crypto. And we know the concerns and the red flags that that raised, because now they can surveil people's spending habits, what they donate to, what they support. And the biggest danger is that governments can turn off the faucet to these currencies. So it's an interesting debate that has nuances on both sides. But I like what your observation that it is a surveillance mechanism, not only for a national currency, but also for commerce that you do on the blockchain. Because, you know, we're pivoting now to all this real world asset financing. People want to do stuff on chain. They want to put their Rolex in a vault, treat it as an NFT, get a loan on it, and do all that on chain. And that's kind of replacing the pawn shop model and the street vendor cash model. So it's an interesting theory you have. I can't say that it's not, I don't think it's that far off the line.
Now,
whether governments
so
are behind all this, I don't know. That's interesting.
Why would they not be?
Well, the one thing is they sure are putting up a big fight against the masses getting onboarded to this stuff. And I think a lot of that has to do, from my perspective, from the law, with the fact that they want a KYC blockchain and they want to make sure they know who's going in and out of wallets. So they're very resistant.
So let's pivot for a second. Maybe it's not insurance, legal, or anything, but you're trying to tell me that we can find Osama bin Laden in the jungles of Afghanistan? We supposedly put people on the moon? And we don't know what Eugene or Carlo or every these bozos doing with fucking crypto? Come on, dude.
No, I think that's a misconception. I know from working in this field and working with federal prosecutors and federal investigators that do blockchain criminal prosecutions, that people have this misconception that what they do on the blockchain is anonymous, and as long as they're working on VPNs and so forth, they're safe. And that is a huge misconception, because everything has to go through the internet, and inevitably you're going to leave a footprint.
Exactly. Exactly. So all we're just sucker. We're just betting on the, you know, it is what it is. It's fine. But we're betting on the house. It's the house.
Do you see a future for insurance on the blockchain? I know right now they're not ready, but do you see a future?
Yes, absolutely.
Talk about that. I'm curious.
I mean, you do a house, and I mean, right now, so I can tell you that there's just so much. When you add a human element to everything, you make a lot of mistakes. So you insure a house, right? Right now, it's harder to understand who did your roof, who did your plumbing. You know, you have to send a person to do an inspection, and there's just manual paperwork. Eventually, all of that's going to blockchain. You're going to click a button, and you're going to get it. It's going to be easier to underwrite houses. It's going to be harder to bullshit. I just think we're 100 years away from it, maybe 50.
And where do you see NFTs going in the future? I know you're a collector. I know there's some projects you love. You're big on Rug Radio. You've been very vocal about that. I know from your prior posts, you've also got a good collection of other NFTs.
Yeah.
What do you see as the future of NFTs? Are they going to be community-driven? Because, you know, we saw Starbucks just basically abandon their token program. And, oh boy, we're not getting, we're not mainstreaming crypto. Do you see that narrative as pivoting at this point?
No. I think as long as we're still doing it, here's the thing. Everything now goes up high, goes down fast, and then slowly evens out. So if you remember what happened in 2001 to 2003, prior to 2001, everybody and their mother was putting out websites. And any company with a motherfucking website domain was valued at 100x what it was making. And then we realized that just because you have a a website doesn't make you a valuable company. And now we're slowly realizing just because there's an NFT doesn't make you a valuable company, doesn't make you a valuable thing. So now we're NFT is such a bad word now that people are cringing about it and they hate it because they've lost so much money because it was such a crazy hype and then huge crash. But eventually we're going to have a home will have an NFT. Right, your house will have an NFT, you can transfer it with the ownership of it. Then you have maybe a collectible NFTs, like a digital picture of a Mona Lisa that's 200 years old, that's going to live on a blockchain, you can see all the who owned it. You're going to have a cars on NFT, like a Carfax. Carfax is basically a blockchain report, just manual, right? All that's where everything is going, just how fast and when, maybe 20 years, 30, I don't know.
So everything all at once ultimately is going to go on chain.
Correct.
And, you know, for the skeptics and for the people that are not interested in adopting this technology, what is the risk they run as far as their own specific industries?
That I don't know. But I know that if you avoided the cars, look, I read something interesting a few weeks ago that the brownstones, you know how the brownstones in New York and why they're called brownstones?
No.
And the steps on them, what that's for. So the reason why they created these brownstones is because when we had horses, they would shit everywhere. So you'd want to create steps into your house so you're not always stepping in shit. And with horses like would like get sick and die in the street, it'd just be create a lot of issues. So they create these brownstones with steps up on your house so you can be a little bit above the ground. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And then when we went from horses business to a car business within 5-10 years, we invented the car, and then everybody that was making horseshoes became obsolete, except very, very few. The horse business died, and horse carriage business died, and that's what happened. Now, 100 years down the line, there's still somebody that's making horse carriages. There's somebody that's making horseshoes, just not as popular.
So just I think if I pull away,
similar thing is going to happen, in my opinion.
I think if I take a 1,000-foot view of what you're saying, everybody jumped in just like in the internet era and got a website and wanted to have credibility as being on Web 2 or Web 1, I should say, websites. But that largely faded because you needed more than just a presence on the internet to be a viable player. And companies did the same thing with NFTs. Everybody and their sister and brother dropped an NFT thinking that this was the way to go, but didn't really have a strategic vision for what to do with the NFT. And a lot of that has fallen by the wayside.
Yep, correct. Which is fine. That's why the whole point I told you from beginning, it was greed, is that if you understood a little bit better, and if me and a gazillion other people were more logical, you would see it early on. But we're making too much money.
And, you know, it is an interesting, it comes in cycles. And right now we're in a very good cycle. And this too will likely pass and there'll be a consolidation.
Exactly.
But the underlying technology will probably, I think, continue to have traction and be sticky and stick around. I want to pivot back to what you do in your daily life. We talked about how you got into the industry. I don't know if we really got into how you hustled and got all the clients you got. So that's my first question.
Yep.
How did you get your clients? And then how do you keep your clients? Like, what do you do? I love to know your process from day one when you meet an athlete. How do you assess their needs and how do you execute on those needs?
Reputation. It's kind of what I said early on. It's reputation and what do people say about me when I'm not in the room. I was very early on. I understood that fast. I'm Switzerland. So when an agent calls me with a player, I don't blast that information to people. I keep that information very private. That's very, very important because the industry is super competitive. And my business comes from various of people, various advisors, various schools, various agents. Some very few people buy from me direct. Very few. The players are way too young to understand insurance, and the parents just trust people more when they come from somebody who they work with currently. It's just what it is. So I'm very, very methodical on preserving my reputation as Switzerland and making sure that I never veer from it. Always I'm very honest. I keep my mouth shut. When people talk to me, I don't repeat that information to other people. And that's how I get my business. And I don't sell, I consult, I advise. I don't think insurance solves every problem. I understand it, that it's a commodity. You can always try to find something better. So people should want to work with me. My phone is on 24/7. You know, we've been on a call for, I don't know, 42 minutes. I had 6 missed calls already and multiple text messages. So yeah. it's customer service. And it's so, not hiding from my clients. I'm very confident in everything that I sell. I solve for a problem. Find a problem, solve a solution, your clients will be forever.
So you got a footprint in Miami. That's where your brick and mortar office is. But I imagine you travel a lot. How much time do you spend on the road?
So it depends. It's very seasonal. So January, February is my busiest travel times of the year. You know, you have the Super Bowl, the Pro Bowl, the Combine, NBA All-Star, multiple games. And what else do you have? Super Bowl, Pro Bowl, Combine, Senior Bowl, NFL Combine, NBA All-Star. So that's 6. My birthday is March 15th, so I like to travel there because I just enjoy it. So that's a lot of travel. And then, you know, you have your NHL Combine, NBA Combine. You have NBA Summer League in Vegas, and then multiple games through the year. But, you know, try to be visible. That's where you can see the people. And, you know, traveling is a lot, definitely a lot.
And I know you seem to be very hands-on. Do you have other agents in your office, or are you pretty much the point of contact for all your people?
I was... as I'm growing, it's time to scale as well. So I actually hired my first guy who just got licensed, and he's working with me, shadowing me around, learning the business from scratch. And then I have 2 more people that work with me. And, you know, we're going to grow. Obviously, the athlete space and high net worth space is very big. The money is growing. The opportunity for more clients is growing. So, you know, that's going to... We have to grow with the industry, obviously.
Yeah, that goes without saying. Eugene, this has been a real pleasure. I'm glad that we were able to connect. It's been a long time since I've had a chance to talk with you. I would love if you could tell the people how they can find out more about you and anything you'd like to say in closing before we wrap.
No, I mean, you've been... Look, one of the main reasons I love Rug Radio is that the things that I've, you know, invest in and believe in is people who've been doing it every day, and you can see what they're doing. Rug Radio has been on. I always see you always making your shows. I think you've been fantastic building your brand and web law, and you don't hide from anyone. So that's a huge advocate for you. So, you know, congratulations on everything that you're doing and keep killing it. I know it's hard to keep building in the bear market. So, you know, people say, you know, it's a, oh, what's 1 year, 2 years? But on a day-to-day basis, it's a really long time. And so kudos to you. And I can be found pretty much anywhere. Social media, insurance guy across all the platforms, Twitter, Threads, LinkedIn, Instagram. And, you know, my email and cell phone is on there if somebody needs to get a hold of me.
I love it. Eugene, thank you for joining. Next time I'm in Miami, I'm going to try to see you, and maybe we can break bread together.
Likewise. Looking forward to it. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who joined the conversation. Don't forget, I'll get this up on podcast, Apple and Spotify for anyone who missed the live show. Wish you all the best in 2024, Insurance Guy. Thank you, Eugene.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Likewise. Bye.
Bye-bye.